Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, Dr. Matthew Jebb on magical plants that have learned to play tricks on prey and predators alike. We hear about the mystery of Lazarus the Blue Tit, who appears to have risen from the dead. And we take a look at a documentary on Netflix called Kiss the Ground, in which activists, scientists, farmers and politicians alike turn to regenerative agriculture in an effort to save the planet's topsoil.
So let's get then to the film Kiss the Ground. And if this doesn't stop you dead in your tracks, I'm not sure what will. The film tells us how the UN say that there are just 60 harvests left on the planet. What do they mean by that?
Basically, they're saying that we only have 60 years of topsoil left on our planet. The topsoil is what we need to grow all our food, fruit and vegetables. And so in 60 years' time, we'll have no more harvests left.
So a very busy programme ahead of us today. We're going to start with Matthew Jebb, who's in the Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. How's business in the Botanic Gardens these days, Matthew?
It's fabulous. The visitors are coming in to stretch their legs.
And are they keeping a social distance?
Oh, they are. No, people are very good. I think people, on the whole, have rallied well in these circumstances. I think we're all keeping our fingers crossed that things are going to go well for December.
And can I ask you, have you noticed an increase in the number of visitors this year?
Definitely, definitely. And I mean, people will see that almost on any Dublin street. There are more people walking than what we've ever been used to. You know, it's become a new national pastime, I think.
Getting out and about. Let's go now to Malahide.
Yes.
Richard Collins is at home in Malahide. Can you describe the scene for me outside your front window, Richard, please?
Derek, it's a beautiful day and people are swimming, believe it or not. Ooh. My wife swims, but I must confess I'm far too worried about the cold to do that.
Yes, you don't want to shrivel up, Richard. And in studio with me, we've got our researcher, John Bellarelli. And Matthew, this is one for you, and I'm sure, Richard, you will want to join in as well. Now, tell me the story you told me about the houseplant you have the other day.
Derek, I bought a plant. Mm-hmm. It's a Calathea macoyana.
Yeah.
Comes in a beautiful mustard pot, bought it out in Monkstown. And it's also known as a peacock plant or cathedral windows plant. It has been sitting at my desk upstairs. It's a very kind of like iconic exotic plant with big oval shaped emerald green leaves with these kind of purple veins on the underside. I didn't realise when I was buying it that at night it raises its leaves skyward into sometimes what's called prayer leaves. And there's a number of different theories as to why it might be doing this. But one of the ones that really caught my attention is that it could be an indirect defense mechanism. And what that means is that it's raising its leaves skyward to reveal the herbivore bugs on the underside of the leaves to passing nocturnal predators such as bats, which pick off the herbivore insects which are eating the plants.
So you're telling me you've got bats flying around the inside of your house?
No.
No, I wouldn't have thought so.
It sounds maybe like somebody's got bats flying around the inside of their head this morning. But it got these leaves. It raises the leaves, revealing these little insects which are damaging the plant from the underside, revealing them to passing nocturnal predators at night.
Okay, and you want to know, is this true?
And I'm wondering, does that theory stand up? What do you think, Matthew?
Well, that's a fascinating story because actually one of the first people to take a big interest in this was Charles Darwin himself. He published an entire book on movement in plants, and plants that exhibit this night movement, sometimes they were called sleep movements because the leaves of plants seem to drop down or rise up at night. So they change their orientation at night. The fancy term that Darwin coined was nyctinasty, which literally means pressed at night. So the leaves become pressed together. So in the prayer plant, this extraordinary behavior was something that Darwin investigated. And he came up with a number of theories, none of which really are convincing. And up until recently, people always wondered, what was this behaviour? Now, one of the things that was initially suggested is, well, it's a good idea. If you drop your leaves down or raise them up, maybe a predator can't eat them. If you think of a horse or a sheep trying to graze at something, a leaf that's down sideways is much harder to grab with your teeth. Darwin also suggested, well, maybe they were just avoiding chilling off at night or by not exposing themselves up towards the sky or trying to shed water off their surface. Now, very recently, a researcher in New York, Peter Minorski, he sort of re-examined a lot of these nictinastic movements. And one of the things he pointed out was that the legume family, the pea family, has a huge number of species that do this. Now, the thing about peas are they are very rich in nitrogen. They've got a lot of sort of protein in them. And so, of course, there's a lot of insects that love eating pea plants and bean plants and all their relatives, the trees and so on. So what Peter Minorski suggested is actually what these leaves are doing is they are reducing the amount of surface area of the plant each night. And doing that means that the predatory insects, the insects that are actually eating these plants, the little herbivores, have less places to hide. So he suggested that this is actually a trick of the plant to make it much harder for a herbivorous insect to hide at night on these plants because they had less places to hide under. Mm-hmm. And therefore, bats, lizards, geckos, all these nocturnal hunters would be able to find them better because they've reduced the hunting space and they've reduced the hiding spaces for these herbivorous insects. He even went to the extent of suggesting that probably mice on a woodland floor, because all the leaves have dropped out of baffling the sound, it means that an owl hunting at night is probably able to hear a mouse running about on the floor, which would eat the seeds of the trees. It would expose it to the hearing of owls. So it's a fascinating thing. And he, in fact, even ran small experiments excluding all predatory creatures from these plants. And indeed, they did a lot worse. They grew less. They were eaten more by the herbivorous insects. So this is something we refer to as tritrophic interaction, which means three levels of eating. And it literally comes down to the fact that the plant's attracting a predator to eat an insect that is eating
the plant. Yeah.
So the old proverb is, of course, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And that's just what the plant is doing. It's welcoming in the enemies of its own enemy.
But if the plant has evolved to do this, how come the insects haven't evolved to avoid being eaten and to understand what's going on and say, we're not going to hang around here when it gets dark?
They absolutely have evolved. It is a co-evolutionary thing. So it's a armed warfare, so to speak, where one side develops a technique to improve its chances and the other side reacts. So predatory creatures are using eyesight and sound, and these herbivorous insects have evolved tricks of blending in with their backgrounds, being the perfect colour, shape, texture. You get insects that look like leaves, that look like lichen. They have endeavoured to make themselves as invisible as possible to daytime hunters and as silent as possible to the nighttime hunters. So, yes, it's an evolutionary arms race between the predator and the herbivore eating on the insects. That is a wonderful part of the way evolution is constantly in action.
Who's going to eat who first? I mean, they must be very slow munchers all the same, Matthew, if they don't munch up the plant before it lifts its leaves to heaven in prayer-like fashion. Hence the reason possibly it's called the cathedral plant.
Possibly. It's also a cathedral plant, I think, because of its incredible colours. The leaves are very colourful. It looked like the sort of tracery of a great Gothic cathedral window. You know, the thing about a caterpillar is it's slow. It's not going to chomp up that leaf in an instant. It's going to be slowly chomping its way through. And a lot of tropical plants, they have all over their surfaces what we call extra floral nectaries. So they're producing little beads of sugar water on the sides of the leaves, on their stems. And what happens is ants come to walk around on these plants looking for this nectar being given out for free by the plant. And the plant is very cunning. It doesn't produce the nectar, say, at 3 o'clock every day. It produces it at completely random times. And it means the ants are therefore always patrolling the plant on the off chance the nectar is going to be supplied, the free food. And in doing so, they bump into caterpillars, beetles, chomping on the leaves. And they toss them off because they don't want their source of nectar being damaged. So the plant is actually recruiting an army to protect itself by giving out a little bit of sugar water to these ants.
But at different times of the day, I was in a place called Shreveport in Louisiana some years ago, and at 2 p.m., a red flashing light would flash over the local donut shop to tell you that the donuts are freshly baked, and people would come from everywhere just to get the donuts. And I thought, what a fantastic idea. But they're doing it at a specific time, whereas this plant is doing it. Does the plant get anything from the herbivorous insects that are on the underneath of it? I mean, is there any kind of symbiotic relationship going on with them at all?
There are some beautiful stories in the African savannah. You know, these extraordinary acacia trees. They look like a sort of umbrellas standing on the savannah. On those trees, you get a lot of sap-sucking insects, little aphids. And these trees have got incredible deep roots going down to the water table. Sometimes it's tens, if not 40, 50, 60 meters below ground level. Otherwise, the ground is completely parched and dry. Now, these little aphids are sucking the sap of the tree, and they only want the little bit of nutrients. So they drop off the honeydew. The most of this sap coming out of them is just dropping to the ground. Like, and standing under these trees, it's almost like it's raining. And what these trees are probably gaining is a wet surface to the soil. Now, in the heat of the day, animals come and stand under that tree. They drop their dung. Mm-hmm. And this water dripping from the leaves through these little aphids is actually washing the dung and the urine and so on down into the soil and helping that tree feed itself with its surface roots, where all the other plants around, the ground is completely parched. This tree has found, if you like, through predation, a way to actually keep its surface roots being fed.
It's extraordinary. Richard.
Matthew, several thoughts occur to me. If you take colour, now plants rely on chlorophyll for the creation of sugars. Now, plants have to be green, have they not, more or less?
Yes.
This would seem to limit what you can do with leaves, yet you say you have all these very elaborate patterns and everything else. Has there to be greenness as well?
The green is only human perception of things, because what the green colour of a leaf is, it's showing us that all the other colours of the spectrum are being absorbed by that leaf. So chlorophyll is absorbing all the blue, purple, yellow and red light. And it's decided, actually, the green is one of the weakest of the light spectra. So it doesn't bother to absorb the green. So that is what reflects back at us. So actually, green is a very gentle light on our, even our human eyeballs, because it's the least powerful of all of the wavelengths of light. So the green colour is merely the human perception of it. And when a colour of a leaf appears very red to our eyes, the pigments absorbing that end of the spectrum are not functioning. So they're allowing red light and blue light to come back to our eyes. So the colour pattern of a leaf doesn't tell us how much photosynthesis is actually taking place. It is still being able to absorb sufficient light to run the mechanism of photosynthesis and generate sugars.
It would seem to me that plants would benefit from cooperating with their neighbours. And we get this, say, in the trees in Ireland. They produce a whole crop of seeds so that things that eat seeds have a field day. And then for the next few years, they starve them. And this helps to reduce the numbers. And when the big flush comes again and they have a huge crop of seeds, they do extremely well. The plant does extremely well because there aren't so many things there to eat them. Here's an example then of cooperation. And many of the mechanisms you describe, such as the one where you would try to bribe ants by offering them handouts, it would seem to me that if they cooperated, they would do a lot better. Do they cooperate?
Plants themselves don't cooperate, and that's one of the extraordinary things. I'll give you an example of, you know, the two peas in a pot together. If you were to grow a pea on its own in two separate pots, each pea will grow and produce a crop of flowers and then fruits. But if you put those two peas together in the same pot with the same quantity of compost, they compete with one another in a ferocious manner. They grow so many roots that they put less energy into producing flowers and therefore less energy into producing a fruit crop. So two peas planted together will produce a smaller crop. So although we like to think that plants don't have emotions, which they don't, but when put together, they will compete with one another, often in a foolish way. They're so anxious to fight off competition that they actually do themselves out of a good living. And it was one of, again, Darwin's extraordinary projects he did, where he would dig the surface off a patch of lawn and allow buried seeds to germinate. And what he would see is hundreds of little seedlings germinate. But as they got bigger, they started to compete with one another. They shaded each other out. They competed for mineral nutrition in the soil. And so after a few weeks, only a dozen or so bigger plants were growing when there were hundreds of seedlings in the first place. And again, this is one of the bits of evidence he advanced towards the idea that there was a tremendous struggle for existence going on. Oak trees in an oak woodland are spaced out because they are so competitive, draining minerals out of the soil, that two oak trees cannot survive next door to one another. And what happens is the caterpillars dropping out of the canopy of the parent tree. If there's a little tiny oak sapling underneath the canopy, these little Tortrix caterpillars, tiny little caterpillars, they lower themselves on threads from one leaf to the next. They are dropping down in their droves on this tiny young sapling tree, and it is stripped of its leaves, so that sapling trees under oaks do not do well at all. They are ferociously eaten by caterpillars falling off their parents' leaves from above. So yes, it's nice to think sometimes that things are cooperative, but by and large, you know, nature is red in tooth and claw.
But only at close quarters. If I'm confined with someone and there's a limited resource, I'm going to fight and he is going to fight. But outside of that, we are going to cooperate when it is to our advantage. Now, you take something like beech trees. If they shed mast every few years and in the interim do not shed much, doesn't it mean it only works if all the other beech trees do the same? So they must, in that sense, cooperate, mustn't they?
I suppose a good example is like a flock of birds. You see a huge flock of starlings whirling around in the sky, and they are not cooperating as much as saying, well, in these numbers, the chances of me being caught by a hawk are going to be reduced. So I will stick with all my buddies here. And by sheer weight of numbers, my risk of being eaten is much reduced. So there's, whilst we might look at it as a cooperative thing, it is actually everybody is being individually selfish, and that is how evolution progresses. One of the big sort of theories of evolution is, why would any animal help another animal in a flock or a tribe or a little community? And this always comes down to the fact that they share genes with close sisters, brothers, uncles and aunts, and there is an altruism there, where you're cooperating with your family members because your genes will survive into the next generation. But things that are unrelated to each other, alas, need to be selfish for the process of natural selection to weed them out. And pushing yourself forwards in nature is the way for success, to get your offspring into the next generation.
The nearest thing to your flock of birds seems to me to be a forest. Now, the trees we see nowadays tend to be isolated, but that's the most unnatural thing for these trees to be in. They are normally in with other trees. They seem to need the community, the forest, because, after all, having lots of them there, they can avoid all kinds of natural problems such as scales and extreme weather and so forth. They're all together. Isn't the forest a kind of anthill rather than an individual lonely animal?
Yeah, that habitat that they create is sort of perfect for one another. And one big thing would be big storms in the winter. There's no better place to hide than in the middle of a forest because you're well protected from the wind. Where if you're an individual tree sitting on a hillside, you are at great risk of being blown over because nobody around you is sheltering you. But these mast years, as they're called, and this year is an oak mast year, so all of the oak trees right across Ireland are producing a massive crop of acorns. Only every 4 or 5 years is this huge crop of abundance of acorns available. So animals that are dedicated to eating acorns, which would have been sort of feral pigs or there's lots of other weevils and so on that burrow into them, they never build up a population of acorn eaters that can overwhelm the crop because for 3 to 4 years, there's a tiny number of acorns being produced. So their population's quite low. And then suddenly, the year when acorns are in superabundance, they are so few in numbers, these predators, that thousands of the acorns don't get eaten. Although, bizarrely, of course, an acorn needs to present itself to something like a squirrel or a jay, which will go and bury it somewhere so that it's buried underground where it can grow nicely away from its parents, so to speak, in new, novel areas. And the hope is that the jay will either forget or perhaps get eaten before they come back to eat those acorns, and that's when the acorn can grow. So the trick of the mast year is not so much a cooperation as a way to ensure that your seed predators never build up a big population year on year so that they're ready to gobble up the whole crop.
Doesn't that employ communication? They all have to tell each other, we're going to have a mast year this year, and on other years, we're not going to produce mast. What is that mechanism? How do trees talk to each other, in a sense?
It would be fascinating to know what they're doing, but they are probably not talking to each other because forests that are completely separated by 40 or 50 kilometres are synchronising their mast year, and they are picking up cues from the rainfall, the temperature, going back several years that we humans are completely oblivious to. And it's all to do with the moment those oak trees were actually opening their little flowers, releasing their pollen grains, which this year would have been in spring. And boy, what a fantastic spring we had. We had an amazing spring. And there's probably a sweet spot each spring. And if that week is just nice and the pollen is being released by the male catkins of the oak tree and the little female flowers are all open and the wind is just right and the temperature is just right, I think there is a massive quantity of pollination events and therefore a big crop of acorns many months later. But we humans have forgotten. And we probably didn't even spot the moment those oak trees were sort of conducting this incredible breeding frenzy back in the spring. And it was probably just that particular week that resulted in the mast year. And maybe that only happens every 4 to 5 years. And it would be great to work it out. But it is often very difficult to go back and say, well, what was the weather like throughout March, April in this particular woodland? And that kind of data is probably, we're close to gathering it now, but it will be many years, I think, before that is actually elucidated. But it shows the sheer pleasure of biology. It is endless what we might be able to work out about the natural world. And we are really pitiful in the way how nature carries on, and we still don't really understand it.
So the picture you paint now is that an optimum year comes along and the trees realize that, oh, this is a good year to breed. So they produce lots of seeds because conditions are spot on. Now, this implies that they all agree this, a kind of parliament, and they issue an edict, oh, we're all going to breed this year. Now, if I'm in this wood where things are optimal in the west of Ireland, they may be the very opposite in the east of Ireland. Now, is this synchronized breeding or synchronized seeding, is that universal? How far does it extend?
Nobody's actually worked it out. Like I say, it's still a mystery. And even in tropical trees exposed to, you know, a very different climate through the year, they will also have mast years. So the dipterocarp forests of Southeast Asia, they also every 5 or 6 years have this mass fruiting, which overwhelms the seed eaters. And again, there is probably the synchronization comes from climatic effects, not the trees chatting to one another and making an agreement, but trees are extraordinary data loggers. Any plant really knows essentially what day it is in the year. They have worked out when the day length reached its shortest period, and they have essentially been able to count through the days. They know what day it is, and every tree has synchronized its internal clock, if you like, on the shortest day of the year. How these tropical trees do it, where day is about 12 hours right through the year, is an even bigger mystery, because we can see how they can synchronize their watches here in the Irish climate, but not how they do it on the equator.
People who deal with animals tend to think that they have made enormous changes. You know, we're not anything as long on the planet as the first plants, the first algae way back. Yet we have gone and produced the Sistine Chapel and the plays of Shakespeare. They have evolved. Such is the development in animals that extraordinary things have happened. And the ways of animals are so extraordinary and so highly evolved. Yet when we look at plants, we tend to think of them as rather static, pedestrian, everything the same year in, year out, century, millennia, no great change. Is this a false view of plants, or are plants equally sophisticated? Have they made as great a stride as animals have?
I think they are probably more sophisticated in that they don't need to find any food. If you think of the animal world, you are fraught with a sort of panic of finding food or catching prey. A plant just sits there, and sunbathing, it gets all the food it needs. So plants have got a truly astonishing world that they inhabit that is so alien to ours, we just cannot empathize with it. We can empathize with animals. We understand an animal is looking for something to eat, just like we might go to the table and see something to eat. Whereas plants have got a different problem. They have got to try and send out seeds into the world, their children. They've got no idea where that seed is going to land or what the condition is that seed is going to land on. But plants have got an extraordinary capacity to deal with anything thrown at them, any environment or soil they land on. They will make a go of it. And they might be a little bonsai tree, or they might be a 100-meter tall giant. And each of those can in turn produce its offspring. And so I suppose, you know, what is extraordinary about the plant world is just how different it is. They must look at us animals scurrying about, desperately trying to work our living on this planet, and they just steadily rely on the sun coming up each morning. So there's a certain extraordinary view of this world. If you were a plant, laughing at the intricacies and anxiety of the animal world when the plant life is evolved a means to essentially enjoy this planet for all its worth.
Fascinating stuff, guys. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Matthew.
Bye for now. Bye.
Bye.
So let's move on. Whether it's Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, the BBC's Blue Planet 2, or Our Planet made for Netflix. Every couple of years, but with increasing frequency, a landmark film or series reflects on mankind's impact on the planet. That film or series raises global awareness, has the power to harness international cooperation and affect policy on a range of environmental issues, most notably climate change. A new documentary film on Netflix has, we feel, this potential. It is called Kiss the Ground. In it, farmers, scientists and celebrities argue that the regenerating of the Earth's soils could be the key to combating climate change, replenishing water supplies and feeding the world. Narrator Woody Harrelson introduces the documentary thus.
This is the story of a simple solution, a way to heal our planet and keep our species off the extinction list. In fact, the solution I'm talking about is right under our feet. We call it soil, earth, or ground. And due to its vast scale and its ability to sequester immense quantities of greenhouse gases, it could just be the one thing that can balance our climate, replenish our freshwater supplies, and feed the world. That's why some people are racing to save our soil, in hopes our soil just might save us.
The voice of Woody Harrelson there in the new Netflix documentary Kiss the Ground. The documentary invites viewers to become soil advocates. They undergo a course where they study soil regeneration, the principles of regenerative agriculture, and learn how to demonstrate these practices to new audiences. Jamie Doyle is a colleague of ours here in RTE Radio. He recently applied to become a soil advocate. He told our own John Bell O'Reilly how he became interested in the power of healthy soil.
Well, from my own background, I'm actually a sound engineer here in Radio 1. But my girlfriend's parents are organic farmers. They're Rod and Julie Calder-Potts down in Kilkenny on Highbank Orchard. And so since I started dating Ruth 5 years ago, and we're engaged to her now, so in other words, my future in-laws are organic farmers, and I've learned so much from Rod and Julie. They've really turned me on to the world of organic farming and microbes in the soil. Ever since then, it's really piqued my interest to want to know more, especially about the science of the microbes in the soil, how there's a whole living ecosystem down there that we've been killing off through using chemicals and sprays and damaging our soils really badly with those chemicals and sprays. And I've went on an exploration and journey of watching different movies and websites and reading books. And since then, I've come across this Kiss the Ground movie, which is really opened my eyes, and I've wanted to spread the good news, as they say.
So let's get then to the film, Kiss the Ground. And if this doesn't stop you dead in your tracks, I'm not sure what will. The film tells us how the UN say that there are just 60 harvests left on the planet. What do they mean by that?
Basically, they're saying that we only have 60 years of topsoil left on our planet. The topsoil is what we need to grow all our food, fruit and vegetables. And so in 60 years' time, we'll have no more harvests left.
So after years of tilling the earth and spraying it with chemicals to grow more food, the soil can no longer absorb sufficient quantities of moisture and carbon and releasing it into the atmosphere instead. And this is a vicious circle that gets worse and worse until the soil eventually becomes so barren that you get vast swathes of refugees moving off that soil all over the world. And we have a clip here by Alan Savory, which summarizes the problem.
More than 20 civilizations in all regions of the world have failed because of agriculture damaging the environment. Their communities could not handle the deteriorating environment and the rising population. Poor land leads to poor people. Poor people leads to social breakdown. Poor land leads to increasing frequency of floods and droughts, mass emigration across borders and into cities, and it's leading to ideal recruitment conditions.
And there he's referring to ideal recruitment conditions for extremist groups like ISIS, for example. And the film points out how numerous past civilizations have collapsed because of their agricultural models damaging the environment, and communities couldn't handle both rising populations and deteriorating conditions. So I suppose in some ways, our civilization is no different in that regard. And regenerative farming could be a solution, Jamie.
Yeah, so regenerative farming is a big part of their approach because it promotes a combination of organic farming. It looks at using no-till or min-till. It talks about cover crop all year round, armour on the soil, keeping your land covered. Because they're using the word regenerative because the word sustainable implies that you want to sustain something that the way it is. Where regenerating means that they want to regenerate things back to the way that they were.
Regenerative farming, which is so key to saving our soil, saving the planet, looks at growing a variety of crops instead of covering endless acres with one or two crops like maybe corn or soybeans, and then rotating these crops to protect and nourish the soil. And if the farmers raise livestock, that they graze them strategically, moving the livestock across acreage so that the animals don't overgraze any particular area. Some people might think, Jamie, that the idea of livestock being part of the solution is a controversial idea.
Yeah, so a fascinating thing in this movie is showing how animals are an important part of the step in fixing the soil and the land, and the way that we keep cows on the land, the way they walk on the land, the way they eat the grass, the way they fertilize, and as they move through the field, they're mimicking nature the way it's done for millennium, and how they're an important part of the cycle to help fix the soil in the way that they're, when they're walking on the soil, the way they're compacting the soil in certain ways in a very natural way and helping break up the soil to the their saliva mixing with the grass, to when they defecate on the ground, that they're walking machines of microbes, that the microbes in their stomach that they're creating, the microbes that then come out of them through their manure is an important part of the microbe cycle. When done correctly through this minimum pasture method that Gay Brown shows on his farm, through his methods of regenerative agriculture, where the animals are grazed through the land the way nature would have them, moving from field to field, it promotes the natural ecosystem of the soil.
And you mentioned farmer Gabe Brown there, and I think here we have a clip about what motivated Gabe's move from traditional tillage farming towards this regenerative farming.
We purchased this place in 1991, and for the first 2 years, I was farming conventionally. Heavy, heavy tillage, high use of synthetics. 1995 came along, and the day before I was going to start combining, I lost 100% of our crop to a hailstorm. So we were totally wiped out. So we were 4 years with basically no crop income. Times were really getting tough financially, and the banker didn't want to loan me any money to buy inputs. I really had to start focusing, how can I make this farm and ranch get these soils to produce a crop without all these inputs? So I started to be a studier of soil ecosystems. I actually went back and I read Thomas Jefferson's old journals because I was trying to figure out how did they do this previous to the use of all these synthetics.
Fascinating stuff, Jamie. So what stuff can our listeners do in their ordinary everyday lives to save our soils and in doing so help save the planet?
So there's two things you can do. First of all, composting, which is very important. And secondly, is choosing organic food products. Because organic foods are basically foods that are created without spraying any chemicals whatsoever. No use of pesticides or poisons or Roundup. So the more you purchase organic food, you're more promoting organic farming, which is fixing our soil and fixing the problems and helping fix our climate and making a big difference.
Jamie Doyle, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Fascinating stuff, boys, I have to say. And John Bell O'Reilly, our researcher, is still with us because he wants to have a look at our social media. John, tell me about Funky. He hasn't been seen for over a month, I believe.
Yeah, last seen in mid-October and described as the world's oldest solitary dolphin. One of the last people to see Fungi in Dingle was Graham Murphy of Bishopstown, County Waterford. Mm-hmm. He said Fungi was in fine fettle when he visited Dingle Harbour with his family in search of the dolphin in September.
Yeah, we arrived, me, myself, Santa, my wife and my daughter Rebecca. We arrived in Dingle that afternoon. We booked a boat and we trawled up and down the harbour for maybe the first 20 minutes and we didn't see Fungi at all. After that, then the captain spotted a red sailboat. There was another sailboat in the harbour. He steamed on out to the sailboat, and sure enough, Fungi was there at the boat. He was playing around with the kids. So I proceeded to take my camera out of the bag and set it up. And just as I had it set up, Fungi leaped from the water. He rose maybe 8 foot in the air. It seemed like he was going over the top of the boat. And when I look back on the frames on the camera, I had let off a burst of shots and I caught him in 7-frame sequence, leaving the water, in the air, and entering back into the water. It was a magic feeling. I was warm throughout for the whole day after it. I couldn't wait to get home and show the photograph off.
So that was Graham, and I believe he sent us a wonderful picture.
Yes, Derek, and you can see Graham's wonderful photo of Fungi just as he describes it in that clip there, looking like he's jumping over the small sailboat on our Twitter and Facebook feeds. And you can see this along with a number of other curious and unusual videos, including one sent in by Yvonne Clifford.
Now, describe this one if you would.
Sure. So it features a blue tit who is laying motionless on its back on a small table outside a rear window. There is a second blue tit moving in a very agitated, a very animated way around the apparently dead bird. The animated blue tit pecks the motionless blue tit a number of times and drags the lifeless bird around the table with its beak. And then, after about 10 dead still seconds, the blue tit on its back very magically comes to life, gets to its feet and flies away. Now, Derek, there are a number of theories on what's going on in this short video from our followers on Twitter, on Facebook. One felt that the motionless blue tit may have been playing dead to avert the attention of a threatening presence. And I know that Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland has another view.
He has indeed. Niall joins us now. Niall, now let me just explain to people, if you haven't seen it, well, do see it. Visit rte.ie/mini. But to me, it looks like the bird flew into a pane of glass and ended up on what appears to be some form of table just outside the window or the French doors. And this other bird came along and, like Jesus Christ and Lazarus, rose again. What do you think, Niall?
Well, I think you're right insofar as the bird does look to have crashed into the window. It seems to have been stunned, knocked itself out, essentially, and that would be the most plausible explanation. It wouldn't have been playing dead or staying motionless because of a predator. Birds just don't react in that way. It would have flown off or behaved in a very agitated way, calling loudly. So it seems to have been accidental. It really is a remarkable video because when I first saw it, I was certain that bird was dead. It looks like many birds I've seen that have hit window panes and have come a cropper. And then when you see the other blue tit coming in, hopping, you know, in a very agitated way around it, I also was wondering what was going on, because blue tits, like most wild birds, they're not terribly altruistic. They don't really care too much about what happens to other blue tits. If they're the one that survives, they're happy with that. So my initial thought was perhaps it was actually a form of aggression, or maybe curiosity. It saw one of its own kind, apparently dead, or, you know, it seemed to be, and maybe investigating that. Maybe it was pulling it around to make sure it was dead, was making sure, maybe to try and make sure that a rival in its territory was gone. And then all of a sudden, as John said, the bird miraculously just comes back to life, becomes alert again, and both birds fly off. So whether it was trying to help a fallen comrade or whether it was trying to make sure that that a rival actually was dead, it's very hard to say.
Is it not possible that it's a bit like somebody fainting when they're overdoing it in the gym? Because this happened to me on two occasions throughout my life, and somebody comes along, gives you a little bit of a slap in the cheek just to bring you back around. And that's what it looks like to me. OK, it's not slapping it on the cheek, but it's pulling at it and it's trying to say, get up, you'll be fine, get up. And then it gets up and goes off. That's, you don't think so?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it certainly, we see it pulling its tail and pulling at the wings. I suppose if we had tails and wings, they'd be very handy things to pull as well, better than a slap in the face maybe. But what the motivation of the rescuing blue tit is, it's very hard to say. Whether it was being aggressive to a rival or whether it was genuinely trying to help, it's very difficult for us to say that. Just to say, though, that birds generally don't help each other out the way that humans would. So if a human being sees another human fainting, we have a natural compassionate response. We want to help. Wild animals don't necessarily view the world in the same way.
I'm just thinking that perhaps Lazarus should be added on to the end of its scientific name. What do you think, Niall?
Why not? Absolutely.
Now, Niall, a couple of weeks ago, I was on the Today Show with Maura and Doherty, and I was talking about kingfishers. And Doherty had asked me, was a kingfisher a big bird? I said, no, it's not a particularly big bird, but it's got a long bill, which makes it look bigger than it is. And we got to talking somehow or other about their binocular and monocular vision. Would you like to explain to the listeners what that's all about, please?
Oh, yes. Bird vision is a really fascinating topic. And birds like kingfishers rely particularly on their acute vision to be able to find food, because they have to plunge into the water to catch small fish. That's essentially almost all they live on. So they need to have very, very sharp eyesight. Now, most birds, if you look, for example, like a robin or a blue tit in your garden, they have their eyes very wide set on their heads, at the sides of their heads, which gives them a good all-round field of view, which means they can see predators coming, you know, from almost any angle. It's very hard for something to sneak up on them. But to do that, through evolution, they have sacrificed the ability to be able to see very well in three dimensions right in front of them. They have to turn their whole head to be able to see something that's right in front of them on the ground. And then it's just a monocular vision that they're seeing there, just one image rather than the two that we humans have. Binocular vision is what humans and indeed other fellow primates have. We have two eyes very close together on our heads, looking forward, and we're seeing two slightly separate pictures that our brains then mesh together and interlock without us even realizing it. So it means that we can judge distance and depth very, very well, but for that we sacrifice the ability to see far to the sides. So for an animal, we human beings have a very, very narrow field of vision. Now for the kingfisher, it needs to try and have the best of both worlds, because like other birds, it is vulnerable to predators approaching it. It doesn't live in flocks, so it's each kingfisher for him or herself. So it needs to keep an eye out for danger. But it also, unlike most other birds, needs to very accurately judge the depth at which the fish are below the water. So it is able to move from having monocular vision, the way most birds do, to having its eyes move forward and to be able to then judge very accurately the distance that fish is just below the water surface. But it's not as easy as that, because that's a task that we humans would find almost impossible. There's another step that the kingfisher's brain needs to do, because, of course, what happens is light is bent by water. So the angle the fish appears to be at isn't actually true. It's actually a few degrees off from where it appears to be. So the kingfisher automatically corrects for that while it's diving and then hits exactly the right spot and very often comes back with the prize. So it's remarkable they can do this all, you know, in the split second without even thinking of it, whereas for we humans it would be almost impossible.
If we could do that, we'd always hook the duck.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Refraction when light is bent by water, correct?
That's it, yep. So that bending is called refraction, that's right. And it's separate from reflection, which is another phenomenon that the kingfisher also has to counter.
Of course,
because
yeah,
there will be glare from the sun on the water too. So refraction and reflection are the two big hurdles that the kingfisher has to overcome.
Well, I'm glad we reflected on that. Tell me, is it a big bird? Was I right in saying to Dolly it's not a particularly big bird? It's the bill that makes it look big and long.
Indeed, that's exactly right, Derek. It's not a large bird at all, and a lot of people are surprised when they see one in the flesh or in the feather, as it were, because they're smaller than they expect. Because we're used mainly to seeing photographs of these birds with a nice close-up, but the bird itself is very small. It's not much bigger than a robin. Different body shape, of course, but as you said, the beak is much bigger in proportion to the body than it would be on a robin or a blue tit or a bird like that. And that's because they use that, obviously, as a weapon to grab the fish, and then they hold the fish in the beak and dispatch them by banging the small fish on a branch or on a stone to stun it, and then they swallow it. So what kingfishers do is when they grab their prey, the small fish, they hold it in their beak, and then they use that to bash the head of the fish off a branch or a stone or other hard object nearby. That's to stun the fish, so that it's not moving anymore. But then they always flip the fish around and swallow it down head first. And that is thought to prevent the scales of the fish from actually getting caught in the bird's throat. And in the case of a fish like sticklebacks that have spines on their back, it's to make sure that those spines will lie flat as the fish is being swallowed. So this again is something that the kingfishers do automatically. They don't have to think about it at all.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And how these creatures have come along so far to realise this by simply putting it down the wrong way could kill you.
Yes, it would be the perfect example of natural selection, that the kingfishers that didn't do that consistently would have been less likely to survive. They would have been more likely to choke or perhaps to have a blockage there that meant that they weren't getting so much nutrition. Maybe were only able to swallow smaller prey items. So they would have been less likely to pass on their genes to the next generation. Whereas the birds that innately somehow did it the correct way, from a genetically coded point of view, were able to live and pass those genes on. That's exactly how it happened. One of the things that we don't fully understand about kingfishers as well is how that brightly coloured plumage that they have evolved. Because it would seem to be very, very obvious. But the fact is that bright orange and that bright blue actually blends into the riverbanks. It's sort of a dappled effect through the sunlight. And it's a very successful species. There are many species of kingfisher in the world, but our species, often called the common kingfisher, is found all the way from Ireland and Iberia in the west, right the way across all of Asia to Japan and the Philippines. So it's a very, very wide range. And it's across that whole range. It's exactly the same lifestyle. It dives in, catches fish, lovely brightly coloured birds. So they're remarkable. And it's one of the smaller kingfishers. There are some species of kingfisher that are much larger. A good example would be the laughing kookaburra of Australia, that wonderful sound they make as the backdrop to many Australian movies and television programmes. It's a kingfisher, but it's much, much larger than ours. There's also the common kingfisher across most of North America is a bird called a belted kingfisher, which is considerably larger than our kingfisher. It's, you know, about the size, a little bit smaller than a pigeon or a dove. It's quite a big bird for a kingfisher. And actually, one has been seen in County Cork in the last few weeks. A transatlantic vagrant seems to have come across, maybe as a result of a storm. So we actually have two kingfisher species in Ireland as I'm speaking to you now, but one of them is just an accidental rare.
Wouldn't it be fantastic if it settled it and found a friend? I was thinking when we were talking about the stickleback going down the wrong way, you could just imagine one kingfisher trying to perform the Heimlich manoeuvre on another on a branch above the water. But listen to me, is the kingfisher the only bird that behaves like this when it's diving for food?
Other creatures do it as well. So a good example would be some of our seabirds, the gannet particularly. They do the same thing. They're able to swivel their eyes forward because they have to do the same sort of depth perception as the kingfisher does. They need to know exactly where below the surface of the water that their prey is. And we also see it with some other birds that rather than diving from the air, like the gannet and the kingfisher do, that just plunge below from the surface of the water. So a good example would be the cormorant. It also has very good binocular vision. Its eyes can rotate very well within its sockets. And not only that, it actually has transparent eyelids, technically called a nictitating membrane, that it can close over its eyes. So they're totally transparent, but they protect the eyes from any kind of debris that might be in the water. And they also help act as a bit of a lens to correct that refraction of light as well under the surface of the water. So it's like having prescription goggles when you're swimming, but they have them built into their eyes automatically. So it's really quite remarkable what the animal kingdom can do.
Now, thank you very much. We'll keep in touch with you and we'll be talking to Niall in the coming weeks. Now, just before we leave you, let's tell you about an interesting art installation around the country. Commuters in train stations across Ireland have been enjoying a little added bird song as part of a new art project. On Chorus, not to be confused with the Dawn Chorus, by sound artist Christopher Steenson, features recordings of the Spring Dawn Chorus and will be played by Irnród Éireann's PA systems from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. until November 29th. The project is designed to brighten the morning commute and uses field recordings from along the banks of the Royal Canal Way made during the first lockdown. Christopher told us where he got the idea.
My name is Christopher Steenson and I'm a sound artist. I'm currently presenting a public sound art project called On Course. The genesis for this project began in the early days of lockdown. I had just returned from New York and was really startled by how quiet it was. Everybody was locked away inside. Nobody was on the streets. There were no cars, no airplanes. All of the usual noise pollution which fills our urban environments had disappeared. And in place of those sounds was the sound of birdsong. It sounded as if the birds were sort of taking over the city. Intrigued by that current moment, I decided to go out and record the birdsong. Of course, it was springtime, the Dawn Chorus was happening, so I was able to capture some very nice recordings of the birds along the Royal Canal in inner city Dublin. Something that would have been very, very difficult to do before, as the sounds of cars and so forth would have usually ruined those recordings. I sat on those recordings for a little while and eventually came up with the idea to approach Irish Rail to see if they would be interested in doing the On Course project. I'm also hoping that this project can act as a way of connecting people together through the act of listening.
And that's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to researcher John Bell O'Reilly. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. And on sound, we had Cara O'Hare. Until next time, goodbye.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.